I talked about the Exodus story a few weeks ago as we moved toward the time of Passover. I focused that day on the Pharaoh and on the hardening of his heart to the plight of the people of Israel, and how the hardening of our hearts can so easily lead us to thinking of our human siblings as other than us. There are lots of examples of this process in our human history that have contributed to today's societal structure and many of its problems. The one I find myself considering most often is the story of the African American. Dehumanized so they could be brought to this country in chains and turned into slaves. Eventually freed and recognized as 3/5 of a person. And finally acknowledged as human enough to cast a vote. And yet still dehumanized in a different way as a source of unacknowledged fear and victim of deep racism that lingers to this day. Our hearts here together have opened much to this story, and this is something that I know and am learning with you. Today's topic is one that I know much less well. It comes from one of our members who brought this sermon, who bought this sermon at our annual fundraising auction. So thank you for the challenge, Lila. Lila is much more knowledgeable about immigration enforcement than I am, and I appreciate this opportunity to explore some of the issues around it. I start with this. What do you think of when you hear the words seeking asylum? My first thoughts were of James Bond fiction, or of high-profile scientists or authors looking for a place to live where they won't be persecuted for their work. Lately, and more realistically, I think of Syrian refugees, people who make a dangerous journey across the Mediterranean Sea or across borders to escape the more dangerous choice of staying in their homeland in the midst of civil war. I've always thought of people coming into the U.S. from Central America as people who are simply immigrants. I think this comes from my own background. When my parents came to this country in the 1950s, they weren't looking to escape terrible conditions and seek safety here. The horrors of Germany were over by then and had not been aimed at them to begin with. So no, my parents, they simply came to the U.S. to seek a better way. And by and large, they found it. And more importantly, they found they had relatively easy access to it. Steady employment, a home in the suburbs, good schools, enough money to live reasonably well. Those things were all well within their reach here in the land of opportunity. I'm learning that many of today's immigrants are seeking asylum. In an article on unaccompanied children coming to the U.S. from Central America, Esther Q.C. Lee describes factors contributing to their decision to leave their countries and how they're perceived. She writes, "Much of the focus has been on the factors that are pulling these children into the United States, like permanent immigration relief, a misconception that some Republicans are eager to stoke to extinguish any chances of immigration reform. But less of the spotlight," she writes, "has been on factors like gang violence, enduring poverty, drug trafficking that are pushing children, some as young as 3 years old, to make the 1,500-plus mile journey to the United States from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, the three Central American countries that make up the so-called Northern Triangle." Lee goes on to describe the factors pushing them out in each country. In Honduras, people choose to travel north to escape homicide, poverty, corruption, and gang violence. They're fleeing for their lives. Honduras has been called the murder capital of the world, and the World Health Organization estimates 85 to 91 killings per 1,000 people in 2014. Compare that to the most dangerous city in the U.S., Detroit, at 45 killings per 100,000 in 2015. 2 out of 3 Hondurans live in poverty, and only a quarter of children there complete middle school. 3/4 of Hondurans have no confidence in the police force, and gangs are rampant and force many youth into the drug trade. In El Salvador, the murder rate is the second highest in the world. People don't trust the police, and 60% of young people are fleeing gangs who will beat or rape those who don't join. And in Guatemala, the murder rates are also high, as is the incidence of rape. Gang violence and drug cartels are widespread, and 3/4 of the population live in poverty. And so they come. Sometimes they come alone. Parents looking for resources so they can provide for their families back home. Their children looking for them after finding it impossible to survive in their native country. Teens and young adults who were brought to the U.S. as children and then later deported, trying to return to their families here in the States. Women who are told to start taking birth control before they go so they won't become pregnant from the almost inevitable rapes along the journey. Sometimes they come together as families or parts of families. Mothers with babes in arms, young children with a parent or an aunt or an uncle or cousin, siblings and cousins with nobody left but each other. They come across the Sonoran Desert, a place where the temperature can vary by 100 degrees in a 24-hour period. 100 degrees. A place of dense, thorny vegetation and difficult terrain and no water. Some are deserted or abused by their coyotes, the guides they paid to get them to the U.S., and many die of thirst or heat stroke. Many who make it are captured by the U.S. Border Control and deported or sent to detention centers. Here's some information that Lila shared with me while I was researching for this topic. Most of the Central American women and children coming to this country as refugees over the past 2 years have been placed in what are called family detention centers, which are actually prisons operated by private, for-profit companies. They're held there for months or years while they wait for their court hearings to prove that they were at a serious risk of death or torture in their home countries. The Department of Homeland Security has a backlog of about 425,000 asylum cases from refugees fleeing the Northern Triangle. These refugee prisons in Texas and New Mexico have come under heavy attack by the ACLU, by Amnesty International, by No More Deaths, by Human Rights Watch, and by other human rights organizations for failure to provide food, water, and medical care, for placing small children and unaccompanied minors in small cells without tending to their needs, and for verbally, emotionally, and physically violating these mothers and children. The most infamous of these prisons was in Artesia, New Mexico, called the Ice Box by its women and children inhabitants because they kept it so cold that they were shivering most of the time and were denied requests for blankets or warmer clothing. Artesia held 3,000 refugees, and conditions there were so bad that the women started a hunger strike. Human rights organizations contacted the news media and the Department of Homeland Security to demand an end to the violations there, and the department finally shut this refugee prison down and moved the families to private prisons in Texas. A couple of stories that Lila shared. Some of these mothers have lost custody of their U.S.-born children while in detention centers because they can't get to their court hearings. Elena, a mother from Guatemala, wasn't even informed that the hearing was taking place in Phoenix until it was too late to fight the termination of her parental rights. Once that happened, she was told she no longer had the right to inquire who had adopted the children or where they lived, and she was deported back to Guatemala the next day and never saw her children again. Ramona had come from El Salvador seeking asylum with her husband Eduardo and 2 children after several family members had been killed by the military and they themselves had received death threats. Because her daughter, Julia, a type 1 diabetic, was 18, she had aged out. She was no longer a child and considered an adult. So she was sent to a refugee detention center in Florence, Arizona. Ramona constantly worried that her daughter wouldn't get the daily insulin injections she needed, and Julia worried that she might never see her parents again if they were deported without her. Eduardo, the husband and father, was also placed in detention in a different private prison in Texas, pending the time when their asylum case would be heard by an immigration court. So Ramona and her 12-year-old son, Rafael, who had been threatened with death if he refused to join a gang that emerged from the U.S. drug war, were released to live with relatives in the U.S., pending the many months or years when their case would be brought to court. Immigration and Customs Enforcement refused to tell her where her husband and daughter were or what happened to them until a humanitarian aid group in Tucson called Casa Alitas made many phone calls to track down where they were being held. When I talked about the Exodus story a few weeks ago, I made reference to our earth as a promised land, and I challenged us to gather our strength and do all that we can to ensure that this one promised land is enough, because it has to be. In a very different way, this country is a promised land to people who have known nothing but hunger or violence or fear or all of them for their whole lives. There's a wide swath of deadly desert travel and a huge fence in the way of their getting there safely, not to mention policies that allow for this kind of inhumane treatment, followed by sending them back to those dangerous home environments. And still they come. Like I said earlier, I'm at the beginning of learning this story. I don't know enough about its history, why conditions are so horrific in the Northern Triangle, what role the U.S. has played in that, how immigration has become illegal. I don't know enough about our policies, what allows us to shut out people seeking asylum, or to separate families in our efforts to get them out of this country, how we've gotten to a place where for-profit prisons are charged with holding people who are crossing our border in fear for their lives. And I certainly don't know enough about its possible solutions, what needs to happen for all these people to be safe, to be together with their families, to be able to live in peace. I said in my description for this service that we would explore compassionate alternatives. And I have to say, I don't even know enough on how to begin that conversation. But I do know what the solution has to be grounded in. Blogger Glennon Doyle Melton wrote these words for the online journal One. Mother's Day wasn't created by Hallmark. Mother's Day was created by a grieved, activist, revolutionary love warrior named Julia Ward Howe. Tired of war, tired of tribalism being valued above the lives of the vulnerable, her pain and hope merged and became her mission. After living through the bloodshed of the Civil War, she called out for peace, and she called out for revolution, and she called the day of revolution Mother's Day. So today, in the spirit of Julia Ward Howe and every other revolutionary for love, let us take back Mother's Day by mothering the motherless. Let us become the leaders we are waiting for. Let us leave our mark on the world and let that mark be radical, relentless, dangerous love that reaches beyond ourselves and beyond our neighborhoods and races and religions and rules and borders and differences and fear. Let our love insist that there is no such thing as other people's children, that there is no peace for a parent until all children have peace, and that there is no rest for a child of God until all children of God can rest. One of the solutions I know about, again thanks to Lila, is offered by a Catholic-based organization she's been working with in Arizona. Casa Alitas receives women and children directly from Border Patrol or ICE who have been determined to have a credible case for asylum. They cut off their wristbands. They welcome them. They let them call U.S. family members who have promised to sponsor them while they're waiting for their court case. I plan to talk more with Lila about the history and the policies and the possible solutions, and I hope you might too. There need to be many more solutions. May it be so, and may we be so.